Good morning, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, we're in Job 6 this morning. If we get Job 7, all the better. But Job 6 this morning, I'll try to wrap this up. And, as far as Job is concerned, what Eliphaz has been saying to him has all the value of shouting swimming lessons from high ground. I mean, there's no value in what he's saying in chapter 4 and chapter 5. All he's been is critical, not at all sympathetic. Wonderful self-control as you move from chapter 5, which is Eliphaz, to chapter 6, which is Job. And Job does not answer any of his caustic statements. Eliphaz's reaction is, Job just kind of changes, He just forgets that and he moves on. Like no other book in the Bible, Job rambles over the landscape of human experience. He asks, for example, in chapter 6 and verse 6, is tasteless food eaten without salt? Or is there flavor in the white of an egg? These are weighty theological questions here, world issues. Chapter 7, verse 12, am I the sea or the monster of the deep that you put me under guard? We look at that and we think, at least I think, wow, what has that got to do with clean water in Wenatchee or butter in Brooklyn? There's no correlation between. And so my point is that we have to be patient with Job as he wanders up and down the lanes of human experience. We kind of wonder why these questions were recorded for millions of people to think about and to chew on. And we look and we think, what's this? And then we, nothing. And then we look again, and still nothing. And at least I wonder about that. So my thought here on this point is that we have to be patient with Job as he wanders up and down the back alleys of life to try to find something that can connect with his situation. And so we just have to be patient with this man as he tries to unscrew the inscrutable. Well, I suggest chapter 6, the outline is here. Job, you can cry if you want to. The pain meter, the preferred motion, and the painless or the profitless messenger. So that's there for you to follow along with. Well, not everybody who's hurting wants to talk. But Job did. He wants his worry weighed. He wants his troubles tabulated. He wants his agony added up. He wants to talk. He's ready. He's ready to talk, and he does. At this point, competitive comparisons really don't help anyone. When Johnny Erickson Tada, who dove into a pool of water when she was about 17 and broke her back and so forth, and now she's reduced to living in a wheelchair, when she's talking to someone who's had a little spiritual owie, she doesn't say, "Oh, that's nothing. Look at me. At least you can dress yourself. At least you can walk. At least you can feed yourself," No, she doesn't do that. She treats them with respect, I'm told. I don't know, but I've read that that's the case. People long to be understood and to be valued and heard and appreciated. And when we listen, do I listen all the time? No. But when we do listen, when you listen, when I listen, it's really a gift of ourselves. The quote of the day is, love permits someone to think aloud in our presence without fear of rejection. Love permits someone to think aloud in our presence without the fear of rejection. Blind people need seeing eye dogs, and people hurting need hearing ear friends. We long to be understood, do we not? And folk music conveys this, doesn't it? I mean, the songs of folk music and country music, There's Tennessee Ernie Ford. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe. Not very good, I know. My soul to the company store. So here's a coal miner who loads 16 tons of coal, I assume in a day, I don't know. He's in debt to the company store. I mean, we all You know, I heard someone say years ago, be nice to everybody, because everybody is having a hard time. And that's kind of stuck with me. Well, let's look at it in verse 1 to 6. If only my anguish could be weighed and all my misery be placed on the scales. That's where I come up with the agony added, troubles tabulated, worry weighed, etc. It would surely outweigh the sand of the sea. No wonder my words have been impetuous. The arrows of the Almighty are in me. My spirit drinks in their poison. God's terrors marshal against me. God's terrors marshal. That's going to be a key thought when we come to this section of chapter 7, satanic terrorism. By the way, this aspect of Job's suffering has never received the attention it should. In the 10 books or 12 books on my shelf on the life of Job, almost none of them touch this at all. But 20 times in the book of Job, a number of different words combined to convey this concept, that he was being satanically terrorized. Terror, dread, agony, trembling, frightened, different words describing terror. And here he mentions it there in verse 4. God's terrors are marshaled against me. Does a wild donkey bray when he's got grass and ox bellow and has fodder? You know, is tasteless food found without salt? Is there flavor in the white of an egg? I refuse to touch it. Such food makes me ill. Well, that is what I'm suggesting to you is the pain meter. He wants his pain metered. And then we come to chapter 6 and verse 8 to 13, and that is the preferred motion. What is the preferred motion? He looks like he's going to die. And so that's what he wants. Oh, that I might have my request that God would grant. Verse 8. Job 6:8. That I might have my request from God, that God would grant me what I hope for. That God would be willing to crush me, to let loose his hand and cut me off. Then I would still have this consolation, my joy in unrelenting pain, that I had not denied the words of the Holy One. What strength do I have that I should still hope? What prospects that I should be patient? Do I have the strength of stone or my flesh bronze? Do I have any power to help myself now that my success has been driven from me? So basically he's saying there that he prefers to die. It looks like he's going to die. He plans on dying. And if you notice that tremendous verse in 2 Corinthians 1, would y'all turn to 2 Corinthians 1 for just a second? And notice, this is a great verse. I mean, you talk about, this is a misery loves company verse. And I admit that's, I'm encouraged by this. I'm encouraged by this misery loves company verse in 2 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 8. We don't want you to be uninformed, brothers, about the hardships we suffer in the province of Asia. We were under great pressure, far beyond our ability to endure, so that we despaired even of life. Now, what does that mean? That has to mean that Paul was so exhausted, that he was under so much pressure, that he despaired even of physical life. He assumed that it was God's time to promote him. And so he says here, we want you to know, understand we're under great, beyond, far beyond our ability to endure, so that we despaired even of life. Indeed, in our hearts we felt the sentence of death. So there's a statement that you can use in your counseling, because there are people who will come to you and they'll think they're going to die. They just want to quit. They just want to give it. They want it to be over. Take them to that verse. Because that verse says, you know, that's an experience that the Apostle Paul had. You know, he's with you there. He's had that experience, you see. So use that one in your verse. Mark it in your Bible. Shade it in your Bible. 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 8 and verse 9. Wonderful verse for you to use. Well, it looks like he's going to die, so he just wants to do that. And notice this. This is really, really something. This is awesome. This is really something that you would think that Elie Bilfar would cheer about. Here is something coming in verse 8 to 10 that we'd think that Elie Bilfar would really, wow, Job, that is just so grand of you. That is such integrity there. Wow. Oh, that I might have my request that God would grant what I hope for. that God would willing to crush me and not loose my hand and cut me off, then I would still have this consolation. My joy and unrelenting pain that I have not denied the words of the Holy One. Now here is something that we would expect for these guys to encourage. You know, sometimes at the end of a man's life, the end of a woman's life, they in their last days or hours, they slip into delirium and they start saying things, you know, all the restraints are removed, and they start saying things that have been long prayed down, maybe some anger issue that's dominated their lives, or maybe some fantasy of revenge, or, you know, something, you know, some carnal, sensual kind of, you know, whatever. And then they're out of their heads. They don't know what they're saying. Now, what's Job saying here is that I want to die before I lose it, you see? Before pain or disease or something like that pries from my lips things that would make God look bad. I don't want that to happen. And so he's praying, he's saying that God, you know, cut me off. Now, far from, this is amazing. Notice that critical word there in verse 10. Not only is Job not cursing God, but he's saying my consolation would be that I died still right with God. I didn't criticize him. I didn't lose my cool. I died in victory. And as I say, I would think that would be something. Chapter 6, verse 10, that they would be encouraging. And even more powerful is that he says this would be his consolation. He would be consoled by knowing that he died in victory. Here's this guy ready to die, and he said, my joy and unrelenting pain would be that I had not denied the words of the Holy. That must have made Satan shudder. I mean, that is just incredible integrity, is it not?
Yes.
Wow. Oh, that we could do that ourselves. Well, the pain meter, he wants his worries weighed and his trouble tabulated. He wants his agony added up. The preferred motion is he seems to be moving toward death, and that's what he prefers. That's what he wants, because it looks like this is what's going to happen. And now the profitless messengers. From Job's perspective, these guys are just of no help at all. They are profitless messengers. So he says there in verse 14, here's a great verse. A despairing man should have the devotion of his friends, even though he forsakes the fear of the Almighty. Why? Because true friends reaching out is a way that those who get away from God will be apt to be drawn back.
Amen.
So when people leave, do we notice them? You know, do we miss them? Do we call them? It's a big church, and people can slip through the cracks. Please keep track of your friends. When they leave, they're crying for help. Many times, not every time, but sometimes. Reach out to them. Let them know you missed them. In our class, look around. Who's not here? Give them a phone call. Let them know that you're thinking about them. You don't have to lay a big guilt trip on them. Just thinking about you. Notice that we miss your presence. Please rejoin us when you can. Doesn't have to be real heavy. Well, a man whose daughter had a serious leg injury, where amputation was a very likely a real possibility, and so the man forbid the surgeon to amputate the leg, and he was just sure that when the surgeon got in there, they would find that God had healed the leg. This man was the pastor of a large church, and he was Dr. Jim Conway, and he was sure that when the surgeon got in there, he would find her daughter's leg good. But let me report to you what he said. When word came that the leg had to come off, I was in shock. I went down to the morgue in the basement. of the hospital. That's where I felt I belonged, surrounded by death. I was struggling to understand why God would allow this to happen. If I was a plumber, I'm paraphrasing, but not quite quoting, if I was a plumber, I could go to work the next day and it wouldn't affect what I did, you know? But because I was a pastor, how could I go back and tell my people that God didn't answer our prayers, you know? And so he just didn't know how he could do that. He said, I sat there outside the morgue and a friend found me. He stood by my side and cried with me and prayed with me. And then two others arrived and kept me talking, letting me spill out my frustration. They didn't condemn me even though I was so angry at God. After one outburst, one friend said, is there anything else you want to say? I didn't have to hold anything back. I didn't have to worry about disillusioning them by speaking my mind. They let me deal with this. Later, a man came to Mr. Conway, Pastor Conway, and said, well, I know why this happened. Look at the revival that's come to our church because of this, you know. Well, okay, there could be some good things come out of it. But do you know what Mr. Conway thought? What about the next time God needs a revival, you know? Is it going to be the other leg? There aren't enough parts of my daughter to keep this church revived. Sometimes even saying I'm praying for you, because people can be really hurting and misunderstand and misinterpret. Even sometimes praying I'm praying for you can be interpreted as you've checked me off, you no longer care, you're not going to waste any more time on me, you're not listening, you know. When people are hurting, they're just not thinking straight, you know. I've been there, you've been there. If you haven't been there, you'll be there again, probably. I remember what Warren Wiersbe said about problems. He said, you're just coming out of a problem, you're in a problem, or you're going into a problem. this whole thing's terminal. None of us are going to get out alive, you know, unless the Lord comes. When people quote blithely who've not suffered, blithely quote Romans 8:28 to the hurting, it really doesn't help. Easy answers dehumanize those who suffer. We simply don't understand what God is doing many times. And so Mr. Conway and his wife had the chance either to get bitter or better. And, Psalms 34:17 says, the righteous cry out. Well, how do you, when you cry, what do you think of? What's the cry? Okay, tears? Okay. Pardon? Sadness?
Loud.
Yes. Do we cry? Or do we cry? There's intensity. There's passion. It wasn't some neat, antiseptic, sanitized kind of thing. It was Psalm 34:70. The righteous cry out. There's intensity there, you know? And so Job, that's where Job is. A sparing man, verse 14, should have the devotion of his friends, even if he forsakes the fear of the Almighty. But my brothers are undependable as intermittent streams. So here's the prophetless messenger's thought. Streams that overflow when darkness and thawing ice are swollen and have melted into snow, but they cease to flow in the dry season. You know, when people and travelers really need something, you know, you guys are like seasonal waters that dry up, and, you know, when people need it most, you're not around. They cease to flow in the dry season. The heat vanishes from their channels. Caravans turn aside from their routes, and they go up into the wasteland and perish. But the caravans of Tema look for water. The traveling merchants of Sheba look in hope. They are distressed because they have been confident. They arrived only to be disappointed. But you too have proved to be of no help. You see something dreadful, and you're afraid. Have I ever said, you give me something on my behalf? In other words, have I asked you to risk yourself to rescue me? Have I asked you to pay a ransom? Have I asked you to help me here, you know? To pay a ransom for me, verse 22, from your wealth? Deliver me from the hand of the enemy. Ransom me from the clutches of the ruthless. Have I done that? Have I been asked for a hostage situation here? Now, at this point, the militancy drops out of Job's voice. And the mood changes when we come to verse 24. Teach me, and I'll be quiet. Show me where I've been wrong. How painful, honest words. But what do your arguments prove? Do you mean to correct what I say and treat the words of a despairing man as wind? You would even cast lots for the followers and barter away your friend. But now be so kind to look at me. Engage my eyes. You know, here's an interesting statement. Engage my eyes. Look at me. would I lie to your face? An interesting kind of a reversal here of roles, because Job is got the moral high ground, and he and Elie Bilfar have lost the moral high ground, and it's interesting that the unhealthy one, Job, is able to engage the healthy ones and look them in the eye and demand visual contact. Look at me. But these people are averting their eyes and not looking at it. When I was a little boy, and my father was correcting me, he always demanded that I look right at his eyes. Son, look at me. No, right here, look at me. Yeah. Something I wasn't eager to do. Eye contact. Have you ever talked to somebody who was like this?
Yes.
I mean, they will not look at you, just everywhere but right at you. Well, I think that's what Job is saying here. Now be so kind as to look at me. Would I lie to your face? What a painful thing when people come to the conclusion that you'd lie to them. That's very painful when you're not believed. Relent and do not be unjust. Reconsider, for my integrity is at stake. Is there any wickedness in my lips? Can my mouth not discern malice? I'm sensitive enough to be aware of sinfulness, guys. I'm tuned in here. I appeal to your trust and look at me. Well, that's chapter 6, or some of chapter 6. Again, I want to close this chapter with the quote again. Love permits someone to think aloud in our presence without the fear of being rejected. Let me see, you want to say that with me? Love permits someone to think aloud in our presence without the fear of rejection. Okay? Now, you didn't have it with me, but I couldn't have it either. If I'd asked you, I couldn't have done what I've asked you to do. Okay, anything else on 6? Chapter 7. In Job. Yes?
In the verse when he talks about he doesn't want to escape the word of God, I forget what verse it was, but you were talking about how people become delirious and so
right.
on. I just think it's a...
Verse 10, verse 9 and 10.
Thank you. Yeah, verse 10.
I would have this joy and unrelenting pain that I not deny with the words of the Holy One.
Yes, that's right, verse 10. So I just wanted to point out that, you know, in our world, there's a lot of evil, and part of the evil is that sometimes there's torture, and Christians are being tortured right now.
Oh, terrible, terrible. Yes.
And many of us have had the opportunity in our exposure to history and documentaries and so on to read or see or hear about the atrocities of the Nazis, atrocities of the Japanese and others, and ISIS now burning people alive in cages and so on. And I guess what I wanted to say is that sometimes I think I worry, you know, would I deny God? You know,
if
I was being tortured.
Would I worry? You hear him? Hear him, Eric? Okay.
If I was being tortured by a Muslim and being forced to say the Shahada, would I end up doing that? And I think part of what I'm kind of getting from this, he's not obsessing over that. Job is not obsessing over that. He's asking, it's a prayer for him.
Right.
Allow me to finish well.
Right.
You know, in fact, you can do that right now if you'd like. This
thing right. Was, you know, yeah, exactly.
Now is as good a time as any. And I think we should be in prayer for our brothers and sisters who are being tortured for their faith, especially in the Middle East right now.
Yes.
I think we should also learn from Job to just have faith that, like you were saying, those who are who study torture can tell you that really anybody can be tortured into just about anything. The techniques of torture today are so sophisticated and have been for decades. That very few of us could withstand, probably none of us could withstand absolute torture. But I don't see that as a deal killer. You know, we are saved, We have the assurance of salvation. And Job seems to be kind of reflecting this. He's not obsessing about, he's not saying, let me die now, because if I live too long, I'll deny you and then I'm in trouble. He's not saying that.
If you have the wrong theology, right, Tony, you'd be in trouble.
Yeah, he's not saying that.
All right.
He's saying it would be better if I died now and didn't end up, saying things against your word. It would be better. So that's my prayer. Yeah. But he's not saying that if I were to deny your words at some point in the future, that my whole relationship with God is terminated or anything like that.
Right. Thank you.
You're obsessing.
Yes. Yes, Marilyn?
I just wanted to add to your thought of listening. I think usually we're so eager to give advice.
Amen.
We're so eager to tell them, but somebody's worse off than you. That's what we're thinking about as we listen. We're trying to think of something to say. We don't have to say anything.
Right.
All we need to do is listen to them. Mm-hmm. Maybe after two or three conversations or less, whatever the Spirit leads you to do, then you can say something. But when a person is really hurting, they just want you to listen to them. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to give anything.
Sometimes just hugging them too.
Mm-hmm. Hugging them, praying with them.
A touch is, when they're in that kind of pain. Mm-hmm. And your words are like Job's friends. They're nothing.
Yeah. You think they're so smart. That's what you say.
I tell people my words can't do anything for you right now.
Uh-huh.
But when you hug them and you show them love, mm-hmm. That's helpful.
Last week I suggested that I ask the question, the presence of Elie Bilfar, how much good did it do? I mean, not a lot. I mean, what can they do? They can't change his boils. They can't heal him. They can't solve the problem, They don't know about the bet. But they were immediate. They were present. They were physical. They were there. They could, it was a person with skin on. It wasn't like God, who's a spirit. You can't see. So, as has been pointed out, you're not expected to answer all the mysteries. They don't expect you to wave your Bible over them and heal them, But your presence can mean a great deal. Well, let's push into chapter 7.
Well, I'm not trying to keep it from chapter 7. But I said this last week, and we ran out of time, and I'm probably making us run out of time this week. But in the Jewish tradition, when there is a death, there is the tradition of sitting Shiva. And sitting Shiva, people may be familiar with it, is basically, it's an open house, and you come and you just sit. You just sit for a week. There's an open house or however long, usually it's a week, and you come, and people can come, usually the family first and then friends, and you come and you sit. If the grieving party, the spouse, the family wants to talk, they take the lead and you talk with them as they want to talk. But if not, you just sit quietly. And the Muslims have picked this up from the Jewish tradition. They kind of borrowed it from the Jewish tradition. And I've been to a similar type of an event at a Muslim death. Uh-huh. And it's the same thing. I mean, it's, obviously they don't have the true faith. But the idea of, just, like you've been saying, you said last week, you said, make yourself physically available and present. Not with the yap, 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 but just quietly and listening and watching for an invitation to speak, but not taking the lead on being conversant like I have been for the last 5 minutes.
Well, thank you. Yes.
I'm sorry, brother. But, sometimes if you tell people what they want to hear, it just levels everything out. I mean, where is that center of calm?
It helps them. Yeah. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I was thinking about this as,
Paul, John, Bill.
Bert.
Yeah. Sorry about that. Anyways, when I was a young man, it's like someone was doing, they were threatening me. I said, broken mentally, okay, you got it. I just told them what they wanted to hear. I didn't mean it here. You don't mean it in your heart. You can tell ISIS anything that they want, they're still going to kill you. You tell them what you want to hear, If you don't mean it here, it doesn't hold water. That's another way of looking at it. And when I'm getting out of Job here, man, he wants God to do things, but God said, okay, no, that's not holding water with me because I know what's in your heart.
Thank you. Okay, hey, there's some slips on the table, and I hope that you're ready to read some verses, and I think we'll skip ahead to something here that I want to work on just a moment, and we'll come back to the majority of chapter 7 later. But I want to work with you for just a moment on something. Do you see the verses there, and can you be ready to read them, please? Christians are sometimes scandalized by Job's outrage. He, in chapter 7, he just gets pretty strong here. Let's see, where am I verse? I'm out of order here because I've only got a few moments left. Eric, how much time do you need for announcements?
Probably 7 minutes.
7 minutes? Okay. So I can go till 22 after?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. let's see. Therefore, verse 11, 7:11. Therefore, I will speak, not keep silent. I am going to die anyway. I may as well just let it all hang out here. I will speak out in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain the bitterness of my soul. When I think my bed will comfort me, my couch will ease my complaint, then you frighten me with dreams and terrify me with visions. As I mentioned, this whole thing about terror has never given adequate coverage in the books in my library on satanic terrorism. But that's what we'll be on next week. But I want to try to deal with this question of whether Job sinned and to what degree he sinned and what could he mean when he said he was innocent. So can you all just read those verses just one after another real quickly, please? Just go ahead and read. It doesn't have to be in any order. Just read them real quick, if you would, please.
Okay. Go ahead. I had Job 13:26. And it says, "For thou writest bitter things against me, and makest me to possess the iniquities of my youth."
Can you read that again? I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear you.
"For thou writest bitter things against me, and makest me to possess the iniquities of my youth."
Okay, the iniquities of my youth. So he's talking about his sinfulness, okay? Thank you very much, LaTanya. Who's got another verse?
Verse 20. "If I have sinned, what have I done to you, O watcher of men? Why have you made me your target?
Okay.
Have I become a burden to you?"
Okay. So if I've sinned, all right, he's talking about his sin. Somebody else. Yes.
"I hold fast," this is 27:6. "I hold fast my righteousness and will not let it go. My heart does not reproach me for any of my days."
Okay, now we'll come back to that one. Yes, Don?
Psalm
thank you, Bert.
"Why do you not pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity?"
Okay, you're talking about iniquity. He admits
now
iniquity.
"I shall lie in the earth."
I don't need the whole thing, Don. Yeah. I'm just making the point that he's talking about sin. Okay? Someone else.
9:21 is, "I am blameless. I regard not myself. I loathe my life."
I am blameless. So, on one hand, he admits sin several times. You see another one? Joanne, you got one?
Job 10:7. "Although you know that I am not guilty, and there is none to deliver out of your hand."
I'm not guilty. Okay? Tony, what do you got?
Job 12:4, "I am a laughingstock to my friends, I who called to God and he answered me, a just and blameless man and a laughingstock."
Okay, he talks about being blameless, doesn't he? Even though he says several times he admits sin, but he's also accused of being, claims blamelessness. Now, I need a verse from Elihu's message here, and I'm not sure I can find it real quick. 33:8. "But you've said in my hearing," so this is Elihu, the young man, saying, "But I've heard it. But you have said in my hearing." I heard the very words. "I'm pure and without sin. I'm clean and free from guilt." Okay. The point is this: we've got these conflicting thoughts. He says I'm a sinner, but he also says he's blameless. Now, what can he mean? That's the position you're in before the living God. That's the position I'm in before the living God. What does he mean? How do we reconcile these two things?
He's been forgiven.
Okay, been forgiven.
Mm-hmm. So you have been a sinner. You have sinned.
Okay.
And you've been forgiven. So you're righteous. Your righteousness comes from God. That's what I think.
Okay, good. Thank you. I'm not disagreeing with you.
I don't know.
As I look for more opinion, I'm not disagreeing with you. Yes.
I know in a general sense I'm a sinner, but I'm not this bad.
Okay. All right.
To deserve what you're getting.
Right.
Okay. All right. Anything else? Yet Job insisted he was innocent. Chapter 9, verse 21, chapter 10, verse 7, chapter 12, verse 4, chapter 27, verse 6. Meaning that, and that's where your verse came in, Bert. Meaning that, number one, he was neither better nor worse than others, and therefore could see nothing that deserved such harsh treatment, or that there was no sin large enough in his life that would seem to deserve the degree of punishment he was experiencing. Now, Job was accustomed to God's forgiveness. I'm reading off of what I'd written in my book, so I'm just quoting here. It seemed that the rules had changed. Suddenly, the consequences of being a sinner rose alarmingly, apparently beyond the forgivable. Now, right here, I want to close on this thought because Eric is ready to go here. I want to close on this thought because right here, in fact, come to the key verse of the whole book, okay? 27, chapter 27. This is a great verse that you need to have in your heart and mind. 27:5. I will never admit, Satan, El Adelphar, that you are in the right. So he knows he's a terrible sinner on one hand. On the other hand, he says, I won't admit it. I will retain my integrity. I will not be cut in pieces. To be integral is to be united. It's not to be divided or cut. See, I will have my integrity. I will never admit that you are in the right. Till I die, I will not deny the integrity that I have through faith in Jesus Christ. We are all terrible sinners. We are all terrible sinners. We are totally ruined people. We are damaged goods. We are needy. But Jesus Christ is our only defense. And we have to, when the evil one comes knocking on the door, and in our stupidity, we're helping him, you know, with our sin, we have to let Jesus and the reality of our position answer the door. Eric? Okay? We'll pick it up there next time. Not next time, next week we have a guest, but we'll pick it up in 2 weeks, Lord willing.
Thank you.
Thank you.